Three. So.
Hello.
Hello. But why is, yeah, no, it's recording now.
So, Hagen and Christian, today we're trying to talk in English. It's very unusual for me to listen to myself in English.
Yeah, don't find excuses just in the first 5 seconds or so. It so, will our be podcast bad. Is instant passwords, by the way. Now, before excuses, we talk about the name of the podcast. Yeah, the week before. We recorded in German, and now it's time for an English one. Just for the sake of it. Germany is not big enough for us, I think. I hope. No, I don't know.
Is it not a Bond title? The world is not enough or something?
Yeah, maybe. Oh. Yeah. Could be.
Who are you, Christian? Who are you?
Who are you? Yeah, I'm an ordinary nerd. what we want to talk about in this podcast is IT stuff in general, I think, since we are digital natives. And we both work in enterprise IT, put it this way.
Yeah, we have worked for enterprises.
Yeah, we have worked for enterprises. Now we are...
I'm mostly for small enterprises.
I'm mostly for HPC, so for big conservative enterprise.
Yeah. Now we are both working for very big. Enterprise.
The biggest of it all. No, most likely not. And but you are more the developer type, like Java mostly, right?
Yeah, that guy.
Yeah, and I'm, as I said, more operational. And I try to hack.
I got some laughter though when we were mentioning that you are operations.
You got some laughter?
Laughter.
Laughter from whom?
From a Spanish person. Out of this office. But I clarified that this makes more sense because sometimes I will throw in some 50 cents and talk about stuff, and that we hope that the listener will be guided through like the argumentation by knowing that I am from the developer side and Christian more from the operation side. That's how I explain it to the South European citizen.
Yeah, I think it's a fair characterization.
Okay, from the first topic, because when somebody was listening, maybe somebody was listening to the first podcast, maybe not, but when there were some...
Oh, I know there mistakes. There were 10 downloads.
Wow.
In the
I definitely hit 5 times the download button in iTunes.
No, don't say
you
that.
Also 5. Maybe we have, like, I know that we have two former colleagues of mine have listened at least into the introduction of the last podcast. Whatever, there were some mistakes from my side, and not, of course, I do not know everything, but there are definitely not a billion tweets per day. There are more just like 500 million. So.
And you said per...
Per seconds, right? Yeah, I said per seconds. So actually that... Way too much. But with another half-baked knowledge, I think that the Storm topology can process even more because one tweet ends up in way more messages because if you have some super node...
Wait, 13.
13 downloads. Wow, yeah. So the data pipeline in Twitter can, I guess... process billions of messages, but the actual amount of tweets per day is just 500 million. And then I said something about SSH, and that was also not correct. Maybe I said a lot more bullshit and didn't fix it by now, but pull requests are always welcome, and so you can correct me if I'm wrong. I'm don't bullshit too much.
Yeah, and I think that since this is an English version of the podcast, if we alternate between German and English, making the errata for German one and the English one and vice versa, maybe, I don't know, we have to think about it.
Yeah. Actually, are the gates on?
Fun?
Are the gates really on?
The gate?
In
I guess so.
Yeah. There's a lot of background noise. If I snip on my coffee.
That's true. But noise gate, it's on.
Okay.
Well, but should I?
Yeah, maybe you can.
Harder here.
Yeah.
Like minus 40 dB.
Yeah. Why not?
36 now. 1, 2, 3.
Yeah, let's just go for it.
Yeah, let's go for it.
So you did also mistakes.
Yeah. I said that the German postal service takes 62 cents, but it's 70. That was a major mistake. And just as an addition, that I talked about the RRD tool last time, and just as an additional note, the first version 1.0 was published in 1999. And today we have 1.5.5, but it's still under development. Yeah.
And so that's 5 minor versions in like 17 years?
Yes. That's true. And wow. And what I don't know if I talked about it last time, but one of the major problems, in my opinion, with the R2 was that it has its buckets. So in modern metric backends, you mostly have like a bucket, and then you push information and you say, okay, this time, like you have buckets that span over 10 seconds, let's say, and no matter what you, when you send it within this 10 seconds interval, it will override what's already existed in this bucket. So you just sort of send a new a new variable or a new value for this bucket, and then it's override whatever was in there. And RRD tool was kind of fun in this, because it's not was not a bucket version, or it doesn't use bucket, but like points in time. So you had like the full second or the full minute, and then minute plus 15 seconds, and then minute plus 30 seconds, and so on and so on. And you have to send it to the exact time. Otherwise, our detour would interpolate and make some assumptions about the value, the next value. So you send, let's say you have T0, you send 1. T1, you send 2. T3, you send at the point of this time. You send at T3, you send 4. And then the first three things you send exactly at the time that it was expected by RD tool, and the other was like a little bit screwed, like 50% off or so. Then it won't save this exact value that you sent, but it will interpolate
automatically.
Ooh. That was fun.
wild guessing.
But I don't know, it's like I used it 5 years ago the last time, so maybe they changed this a bit. But yeah, okay, so the prologue We finished, I guess. At least there's nothing else on the Zender plan.
Yeah. So now it's your turn to talk about.
Yeah, we have
Polaroid.
Maybe for the, how do we plan to do the podcast, or did we did it last time? Was we talk? We have like a couple of topics that we want to talk about, and then we usually only talk about one because we are out of time. Then the podcast should not be longer than an hour, we said initially. We will stick to this rule, and I have two topics, but maybe I will skip the last one anyway. The first topic is Polaroid. I talked about it last time, and since last time I forked Polaroid and made it my new project, or a new project, a fork. I called it Kniep Collect to make it more brand. No,
which is always a good idea.
Always a good idea. No, and because I think Polaroid is very nice. Polaroid is written in Go, which is good by design. No, I like to play around with Go. That's why I like it. And it has a notion of collectors and handlers. So you can, as in many of the metrics collection agents, you have a couple of collectors where you can say, okay, collect the CPU information, collect memory information, collect any information, whatever. And these are distinct processes. Within Polaroid, it's not even a distinct process. It's a Go routine. A Go routine. It's like a green thread, or what is it called in computational theoretic terms? Ooh. And they are distinct. So if you have like five collectors, they are all, quote unquote, forked from the Fullerite process, but they are just Go routines, and they communicate via a channel like this multi-threaded or in Go you have this notion of channels where you can communicate between different threads.
The paper behind it is communication sequential process, and it's
here we go
backdated in the 70s, and Go has a nice implementation of it. And the building blocks are Go routines and channels and the operations that you do on the channel. It's different actually from the implementation in Clojure, because Clojure relies on the GVM. And so in Clojure, Go block is not bound to a thread, but bound to a thread pool that is assigned to a Go block or not. And in Go, this is it's more native to the instruction set, I guess, into the new architecture. So I think you're very right with like green thread.
It uses I read some, but it's a little while ago. So a pthread, when you fork normal processes, has, I'm not sure, I think 128 kilobytes or so. Anyway, it's before I ask Google, maybe it's fairly large, and the Go routines, they have was at least 10 times smaller, but I think even much smaller overheads in terms of heap of memory usage and so on. So you can and changing from one thread to the other, from one green thread to the other, is also not possible. But this is maybe that's thin ice for me. Maybe you have much more.
I never looked into Go actually, so I it just has to be done differently.
Yeah. Anyway, it's very lightweight and it's fast. And since Go has this channel notion or this concept of channels, where you can easily communicate between different threads, and it's implicit, or it's like a concept that is baked into the language, it's very easy to do the communication between different threads, which is in other programming languages is like more cumbersome. I think with Python 3.5, there's some nice feature that you can easily or more easily communicate between different threads. But normally it's a kind of a hassle to do this right and to have like locks and all this.
I think in the same manner. Basically two challenges to it. One is like the syntax that the language provides you for expressing yourself in terms of concurrent programming, and the other thing is your mind that is limited to think in terms of concurrent programming, because it's actually very hard.
My mind, or in general the human mind?
Well, there are special people who have more capabilities but I guess also these people have some limitations, and it's actually hard to think about progress. So these are the barriers, and if you have your tool chain not in the way, it definitely helps to do some good or concurrent programming that can be followed by other people looking at it, because the syntax makes it easier to reason about. But then still, I guess you can always shoot yourself in the foot with thinking about what you're doing.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. But coming back to Fullerite, they use, as I said, they have collectors and handlers, and the collectors are basically just the producers of metrics, and they push it to a channel, and all handlers are hooked to this channel, and they all consume the metrics that are produced by the consumers, right? So it's fairly simple setup, the simple framework, and therefore it's easy to write a collector, because it's just three functions or methods you have to implement, and you have to push the metrics to the channel, and off you go. And for the handlers, the same. You just have to consume the metrics. So it's fairly simple. And since this concurrent programming and this this communication is hidden within the Go channels, it's fairly easy to use. And what is also nice about Fullerite, it's backwards compatible, so to speak, to Diamond collectors. So Diamond is a very, or not very, but famous Python-based metrics collector, which has the same concept, but it's Python. So yeah, the framework Python. So it just uses standard out as a way of communicating. So the collector is printing on a standard output, and since it's forked from the main process just consumes what's printed on standard out, and so it's not that standard out, but on the console, and then pushes it to the handlers. And FullWrite provides a way to reuse all the diamond collectors, so it's very easy to just drop in FullWrite and then use your favorite Python legacy collectors until you have provided Golang versions of it.
So if you collect, like for instance, you're running on a machine that has some, I don't know, some stuff running that you want to collect metrics on, you just call it via whatever is available. Say it has an HTTP API that gives you back some JSON, call this locally, and then you put the result onto a channel. But this, where does a channel end? Like, what's on the other side of the channel?
As I said, there is a handler. And the handler can, the simplest handler is a log handler, where it just prints it on standard out of the FullWrite process. There is a graphite handler. There's this squeezing again. You heard it?
Anyway. No, I didn't hear it.
And then it's just me. Anyway, there's a graphite handler, and there's some other SignalFX or some more, internet affiliated handlers, like for services that you can use. I wrote an InfluxDB handler for the keep collecting, and I upstreamed it to FullWrite as well. So it's just, I think it's already merged, or it's about to be merged, I don't know. I also wrote a ZeroMQ publish handler, which I'm really proud of. So you can just hook on a ZeroMQ publishing socket and then receive all the metrics that are consumed by the thing, by the FullWrite process, or by the FullWrite framework. And I'm also working on a ring buffer handler, so that you can, all the events, all the metrics are pushed to a ring buffer, and you can specify how long the ring buffer should keep the metrics. So let's say the ring buffer keeps every collected metrics for 5 minutes. And in the highest available resolution. And the InfluxDB handler might downsample the information to 30 seconds intervals, for instance. So your collector collects all every second, then Influx is only sending aggregates of the last 30 seconds. That's my idea. And then if there is an incident or an accident or some outrage that you want to look into, you can just hit an endpoint on the ring buffer handler. Please republish all the fine-grained metrics from your ring buffer of this host to the InfluxDB handler, and without the InfluxDB handler downsampling it. And then you have a more fine granular metrics in your backend to look into what might have happened during the problem that you encountered. Because I think that's one of the trade-offs, or that's one of the trade-offs you have to do if you collect metrics. Either you collect metrics very fine-grained to be able to look into problems more detailed, or you collect metrics not that fine-grained, let's say 30 seconds or maybe a minute interval, and then you have informations about a longer time span because you have limited space, so you cannot sample it every second and save it for years. You have to make a trade-off between high volume and frequency. But if you can say, okay, I have a problem, please ring buffer, push all the fine-grained metrics to the backend after the fact that you encountered it, I think that's something that would be nice. And this I tried to do with this ring buffer thing, so that you can send metric, resend the metrics in a higher granular scope. And I called it metric. Funny German project name.
You have, like, I recognize that this trying this in English is less funny than doing it in German. Because we're just like not that good in making jokes in English. But Mettring definitely is a laughter.
That's that's really a funny thing.
Just like all English speaker, please laugh out loud. It's
very funny. It's hilarious. Funny. It's hilarious.
Yeah. What about Bauarbeiter Marmelade?
We called it Feuerwehrmarmelade.
But what is Met actually in English? Is it minced meat? I think it's minced meat, and then you have some onion to it.
No, it's an English word. Met.
German, yeah, to meet somebody.
Meat. Ground pork.
Ground pork.
Wow. American is.
American. That sounds not so lecker.
But Zwiebelmet is onion met. Here, if the English speakers don't know the word met, learn your language, guys. The dictionary says met.
All right.
German means pork. Okay. It's an English word.
And then, yeah.
Why? I have echo as well?
No, I don't have any echo, but you are rubbering your shoe on your on the ground. That makes noise. And I'm really sure that the gates are not working properly. Can you make it more stronger?
Now it's 30 seconds.
It's not 30.
Yeah, 30 decibels. Minus 30 decibels.
Rubber your foot on the ground. Can you hear it? I can hear it. Make it more.
Yeah, but I can hear it because...
Make it stronger.
25. Minus 25?
No, you need like minus 100.
But it's look here, it's like there already. 1, 2, 3.
Doesn't cut out right.
But it's now nothing is left here on my headphones. Can I hear it right now?
Then on like yeah, maybe you should hear it on your headphones and I can't hear it on mine. That's maybe the problem because mine.
Yeah,
going through the loop.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah.
Okay.
Then you're not getting the noise. The noise
gate. I'm getting all the noise.
Yeah, but you're not getting the noise gate because the noise gate is on my laptop and you're plugged into the mixer. Okay. That makes sense.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry. This we will cut out or maybe not.
That's classic amateur radio.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so Knie Collect, I like it. I play around with it a lot these days. And but this is fortunate because otherwise I would talk about Docker all the time. So,
yeah, you will get your chance. Yeah, you. If my next contribution is too boring, we have another 5 minutes of.
I don't think so.
You need to sing it or rap it. About Linux containers. Well, yes. The last time I mentioned a blog post where somebody was telling why he is not
job based. There's too much gate.
Yeah, and then softening again. It was about Rails and why Rails is not so nice, and I was like. And then this week, I mean, it's easy to rant about a language, and it's like for certain that some people really like to rant about like Rails, and then as you can imagine, there's a lot of hatred going on the internet. What my contribution would be today is like to get a more, I don't know, not so hateful but still valuable. Idea of I think what it's about to write software and why we see so many problems with languages and their stack and their complexity, and that's basically all about it. So there's a new another Rails rant out on the web, which is called My Time with Rails is Up, and the guy is he has worked basically since the beginning with Rails in 2007, 2006, something like that. And he argues that about like the convenience of Ruby, right? Or the Rails. Everything is very simple. and by simple. Oh no, I got it wrong actually. It's very easy and it's not simple. And I'm talking about the term simple and easy with regard to the famous talk from Ritchie, Simple Made Easy. So a simple thing is a thing that is like the opposite of complex. And from the origin of the word, it stems back to like simplex, which is like a thing that has only one twist or is like really, you can think about it in one thing. It is like one abstraction. It's one thing that it does. It's like, it's not complex, right? So
are we a linguistic podcast as well?
Yeah, we are, because words matter.
Yeah, sure.
Right, and the author of this blog post argues that because in Rails everything is simple, it ends up under the hood being very, very complex and not easy. Still, I got it wrong. So it's very, very easy, and it's not simple behind the scenes. And he has some nice... Here's one code example when you create a user and what it does and how the object mapper in Rails does a thing. But he also talks about the community itself and how some, like, how the core of the Rails team prevails or shields the core and doesn't allow any new abstractions or any new ideas. And then when there are new ideas, then the Rails project will merge stuff into it. And so there's no like really good alternative in the Ruby world, I guess. And I think this is all not very uncommon, and this is not specific to Rails or the Ruby community. And what I was thinking of is like when you build bigger applications, you always come to the point where you start off very simple and have like and simple and easy, and that part of a project are still very nearby. Like you don't know so much, so you don't end up doing very complex stuff. And then you use it yourself and everything is very small. And so you make it easy for you to interact with everything. So the concept of simple and easy are still not diverged. But then the system gets bigger and more features get added. And maybe your project grows and there are more people contributing and you lose this. And if you don't have strong guidelines or strong... I don't know what the key...
Maybe it's a good analogy that to cars. I mean, back in the days, 100 years ago or so, cars were simple. Like, they were really simple. They were not easy to use. I mean, there are videos out there to how it is to drive a T Model T, which is not really something that you want to do. But the car basically was simple, but it was not easy because it was too simple. And even before that, when cars were built, you got the frame. So you got the frame, the engine, and everything you need to drive. But you gave it to an outfitter which does the carriages normally, and then he put on top the
stuff that looks good.
Yeah,
the bling bling,
the bling bling, and the seats and everything. So that he basically built a carriage out of it, or a carriage, a horse carriage. Yeah, the carriage. He just put a carriage on this horseless carriage. Yeah, so and nowadays, and maybe in the 30s or back in the days when we were young, like yesterday, the cars you could repair with a hammer because they don't have much electronics, like a Golf 2, or they were quite simple.
Yeah.
Or simpler than today. It's more easy to drive a car nowadays with automatic shift, and you have like... ACs and all that.
Yeah, and will look for you around the corners, and it will brake for you because that's all too difficult. Humanity is overwhelmed by the situation in real life traffic, thanks to the millennials.
Are we like millennials?
I'm not.
Damn it.
So yeah, I guess that kind of working. But then there's like still not everything, I guess, in the car industry is like really, and because they are like, I don't know, maybe 100 years older than our industry, it's still that the of course these parts and pieces are more complex and they are more like convoluted or put together in one thing, like the board computer that does the injection stuff and the gasoline control unit mixture and everything. Yes, it's a control unit. It's one complex piece, and then if something doesn't work, you throw away the whole thing. You don't go in there and fix anything within that unit. This unit is designed to be just replaced, which is a lead into your next topic, but that's not what I want to talk about. So the thing is that these rants about how is everything complex, how and it's always the same argument. It's about dynamic and static languages. It's about the dependency management. It's about architecture or design principles for a specific tool chain. Like, how do you design your application in Rails? How do you design your application with Spring? How do you design your application with, I don't know, the Scala Play framework or HTTP, Akka HTTP? What's a good design and what's robust? And something is always specific to the framework itself because it has its limitation and its features. But then in general, how do you like, it's always ending up in this, and I have this notion, I think it's not that, well, I can't like really agree with all that Rich Hickey said about easy and simple. I mean, the definition of the terms and where it's come from and what we should focus on, I guess that's all right. But then when we actually work, we have this flip-flopping of simple and easy. It at some point, stuff is very simple, and then it is also easy. And then sometimes we try to make stuff easy, and to make it easy, we actually end up making stuff very complex. And that's like, I saw a game a friend of mine programmed, and he was like showing a bit off how he used type theory and Scala set and everything, and it was like, it was actually beautiful code, but then, and the game itself was just like 5 lines or so, and it played the whole game, just 5 lines of code. But behind the scenes, there were so many abstractions and definitions that has to be made, which were all fine and like nicely done, but it was complex. So at the surface, you want to have something easy when you give it. I guess that's the point. Who is using what in your application?
Yeah, isn't it that simple is not bound to the domain and easy is domain bound? So it's easy because you are from the same domain, or it's easy because you target the developer do you want it to be easy for the developer, or you want it to be easy for the manager, or you want to be easy for your specific domain, like for HPC or for games or whatever, so that you cannot target something to be easy for everyone. You have to pick it to be easy for some specific type of guys.
Yeah, and that's a question. Like,
and simple is, it's not that, right?
Simple
is agnostic to the domain. It's simple or it's not simple.
Well, yeah, that's actually how the topic, like how Rich Hickey explains it. Easy is something that is nearby, that is like, because you have a condition that you know already a lot of stuff, some stuff for you is easy to grasp. It's not hard for you to get the idea because you have a decent understanding of it anyway. But then simple really refers back to not so much intertwining, not so much like, the thing that you need to understand is just there in front of you, and you don't need like, oh, when what you did for the last 2 or 3 weeks, you were like poking around with an application stack where you had to find a piece here, and then you had to go to another component of the software and look at a piece there. And if you try to get all these points together in your hand, and then there's this failure of humanity, we can only pick 5 to 7 points at the same time in our memory and reason about it. And if you go beyond that, you're lost again, and then you try to pick the stuff again, and it's very hard, and it's not the fault of the, maybe it is the fault of some developer, but at the end, nobody focuses on this limitation of the brain that you actually, when you have some stuff or a function body, it should explain itself. It needs to be like five lines of code. This you can understand and grasp. I mean, if these are nicely decoupled and not like depending on a lot of other stuff, you can actually understand it, and that makes you faster. And that is simple, because you can grasp it one piece at one thing, and it's not intertwined and stuff. But coming to an end in this talk from Ruchiki, there's one side that is from Professor Sussman, and I want to just read it. So I will just read it. As we make things more flexible and extensible and dynamic in some possible future for some kind of system, we are going to make a trade-off in our ability to understand their behavior and make sure that they are correct. But for the things that we want to understand and make sure are correct, we are going to be limited. We are going to be limited to our understanding. And I think that's key. Like, if you want to be really precise, really exact, really like perfectly proven, you cannot be in any ways complex, because that's beyond your understanding. And that's for instance, ADA, right? The language ADA, which is used in atomic power plants, for instance. Very simple stuff. Get the thing down to the water and up. It's just like a two-dimensional movement of a pump that goes up and down. And it's a very simple thing. And this is to be proven to be right and to be function. But then this language doesn't allow anymore. So you can do the simple stuff and you can make it correct. But what we are doing in our industry or in our web application stacks is almost like it's beyond anything simple. And that's, I guess that's the reason why everything is so faulty. And to get an ending here is, yeah. I think
just to get this, the two sentence you just read, right? I mean, I think I at least was trying back in the days, was trying to make everything like try to foresee what it's supposed to be used for, and then at the end say, okay, I need this because in 2 years or in the foreseeable future, we need this feature. And then I just put too much functions and too much complexity in for possible usages in the future. And this is what you were just talking about, that we should keep it to our current time frame and our current use case and not try to foresee the future.
Yeah, that like there was a later talk from Sussman. But he is like way beyond this. It's like this. He talks about like actually system architectures, and to like he's only like what this for me. What he's saying is, it's the trade-off. Like if you want to have an adaptable system that is autonomous and can work in several ways and can adapt and react to its environment, you need to be aware that you trade preciseness and precision and understandability for like the ability to adapt, because you need to make a more complex system, and then you won't understand any detail. But if you can have a problem at hand that you can precisely describe and understand in one thing, you can make it exactly that precise.
Yeah. Okay.
And because the limitation here in making it that precise and that exact is your ability to understand the topic at hand. Mm. And that's always the case. Like, you cannot go beyond your capabilities. It's we are humans, and that's, we are done with a certain level of problem.
Yeah.
And I think the to wrap it up, the main part is I'm still not there where like simple versus easy is not like, for me this diverges at some point. At the beginning of my project, everything is simple and easy. And then when I come to legacy code, some stuff are really nice APIs, nice colleagues did decent work. It's very easy to use. It's function. It's like working. But then it's maybe not simple. And then sometimes it is very simple, but then it's not easy. It's like not easy to use. So at some point these diverges, and this is like, it's flip-flopping for me, and I don't see where I didn't came around something that is like perfect in any regard to both aspects of simple and easy. And also I think what is also not true, and what also is not the point, is like the discussion about a monolith or the separations of concern or like bounded context.
But just wait, that's the simple and easy thing. Just once more, it could be simple and easy if it's just a very simple task that you want to do, right? So it's more if you have like a microservice. I mean, this password we have put in here somewhere.
Yeah.
If you have like microservices and you can chunk your functionality or your domain up in very small pieces, then it could be both. Then you have maybe a complex system built from very simple and easy building blocks.
Yeah, and then that's
screwed.
that's what they try to sell, right? Or try they is like real expensive consultancies and real expensive software shops. So you do everything microservices. By the way, when I was moving last week, I found an old IX from the Heise thing from 2007. And it has the SOAP thing all over it. Like,
yeah, you
it says,
tweeted it, right?
Yeah. And it was like service-oriented architectures. And now we call everything microservices. It's the same thing. It doesn't like, and we need a new word because people found out that SOAP didn't work for them. And now they will do microservices and they won't work for them because the problem is not like making an HTTP API out of it throwing everything into an enterprise bus. It's like that's not the solution. The solution is actually decoupling, understanding, and then building or hedging like a certain problem and solving it in one piece. And that's simple, and that you can like this should be a microservice, but then like deploying 100 different microservices in a huge organization. Simple. That's not simple, and that's also not easy. And then you have this thing that these are depend on each other. So you make a distributed monolith, and it's almost I don't think that even if you say you can end up in a distributed monolith, I think there's no way around it actually to not end up there because these components need to talk to each other, and the only thing is like. Yeah, I'm not so sure if you can really make a reasonable large system so undecoupled that the amount of conversations that the services need to make in between each other are reducible to like a really simple amount. I'm not buying it.
Isn't the legend of microservices that SOA was It's the same as ITIL, I think. You know, ITIL, this handbook how to do IT operations.
Oh no, I didn't know that.
Ooh, you're a lucky bastard, because ITIL is in the enterprise IT is everywhere. Like if you want to be a service provider for some big company or even for smaller nowadays, you have to comply with the ITIL handbook version something like version 2 or version 3, and. So I work for automotive companies, and you have to do this. Or they were changing their model of operations to outsource everything and to make it compliant with the ITIL model. And the ITIL model is you have different layers, you have different responsibilities, you have a change process, you have a rollout process, you have a problem, you have incidents. So incidents are like, could be that there is an error on your laptop, and if this incident pops up 5 times a day, then we might make a problem out of this incident because it seems to be a repeating mm-hmm. incident, so we make a problem. And so this ITIL, it's a handbook, I forgot from whom it was, but anyway, it's now basically an enterprise IT standard of how to model your operation. And then you have like level 1 help desk, a level zero help desk, and the help desk is a single point of contact, so you cannot call your developer right away. You have to make a Jira ticket in the help desk, and then it will trickle down to level one, and then level two, and so on. Anyway, but this was like pushed
German from the Verwaltungsgesellschaft.
No, but it's international. It's not even German. And this is pushed out from the IT management down to the operation, right? So that's not something that was created by the guys on the ground. It's like maybe it is to some degree best practice, but then some IT management guy took over, and then now it's like a handbook that you can follow as a management guidance. And for SOA, isn't it the same, that SOA was a handbook or best practice, or not best practice, but was something that was theoretically okay, but on the ground it was not a grassroots thing that came up from underneath. It was a concept which never really worked out.
I think SOA and microservices are really buzzwords that are like talked from really expensive consultants to CEO level managers or C-level managers. And in the end, we are not any better. Like, developers like to like be the first with the buzzword, and then like opt in, like adopt it early, and then opt out early. So you're always like hip and modern and stuff. And then like these are like the millennial hipster coders, and I have to be honest, I'm kind of that too. I like to jump in very early and then jump out very early, and then it's not good. It's not cool for the sake of reusability and really reliable engineering. And that's what our industry lacks. That's reliable engineering. That's like really like we are or we shouldn't call us. There's also somebody wrote about it. We shouldn't call, no programmer should itself call an engineer, actually, because engineers do proper stuff like rockets that land on the moon or
atomic
power plants.
We talked about it in our last podcast in German, where we said like an engineer or an architect would build a bridge, and he would know all the bounding content, all the constraints, and how many people would go over the bridge and so on. And in software architecture or in IT architecture, it's like, yeah, we need a rope to throw over some stuff. And then if it's going to be a highway or if it's going to be a railroad, we don't know, actually.
Yeah, we just like, it's also, it's really broken. I guess there are really smart people, but then all these smart people have no like it's really hard to say. And then there is the guys who want to sell a lot of stuff, like pushing a new meme through the pipes and through the social media just works, and they sell consultancy hours. People will rebuild their stacks and everything, and it's a huge hype, and it's a money making scheme, and that works to make money, but it won't work to make decent software. And then basic principles are almost always forgotten, or I don't know if they are not right really educated. And then on your day-to-day work, like on the ground, you are so busy with getting anything done because of the complexity that is already there and that you need to fight, that you really don't concentrate on proper principles.
And then you throw in all this ITIL shit that I just talked about. And we don't call it ITIL, but we have also like change management, incident management, development management.
Yeah, I mean, that's, I think even if I get your idea right, I think there is something to it, because it's actually laying out some principles.
Yeah, sure.
And then and these seem to like not be really off the rails.
No, don't get me wrong. It's a good concept, like having guidelines, having best practice, and this is where it started, and I think it's still it's still best practice. Sometimes the problem is that if it gets too complex and too big, then it's more likely that the management tries to push the principles of management down to the ITIL stuff, and then it's not best practice anymore. Then it's best management practice or best process practice, and then it's becoming weird.
And then it's not valuable anymore.
Yeah,
because it is valuable to protect your developers from screaming users that are just not giving like any valuable input.
Yeah.
And it's good to get the input from the user, but it's not good to distract your developers with unvaluable input. Yeah. So that's a good step. And then there is like these rules. Like I did know this guy where he like came into the company and figured out that we need now, 100 of editing rules for Java and what is like code envy. That doesn't contribute to the end product, to the user of the software that this company was selling to other people. So it's just overhead, and it has no value. And and then we do the Scrum thing, and I think that could be a good topic for the next German thing. I like to rant about Scrum, but no organization at all, right? The process is not defined in any means, and it's so vague and so abstract that anybody can do anything with it, and it mostly ends up in an absolute hell where you have unmotivated, frustrated people on the ground, people who need to work but can't, and are like distracted all the time by process, and that's very bad.
But
and
then
we
you
call
can
it
say,
software engineering.
But then you can say you're so agile, you can deal with these unmotivated guys on daily basis.
Yeah, great.
So you don't.
Great.
You don't.
But then I think it also like lacks vision. Like there is like
sure,
because it's not it's easy to say your managers suck because they force you into a process, but then you suck maybe because you let go with that process and you let it be that you are frustrated with the process. You didn't change anything. It's also your responsibility.
What is the solution then? So let's fix it. What is the solution? Is it that, I mean, I like this notion of having small teams, and I read the other day that your company should not be bigger than 150 guys, otherwise it's going to be too complex to hurt the...
These range from 100 to 150 to I also read 200 is about how many relationships are you able cope with.
So you have your team of maximal of max 10 people or maybe 15, so
yeah,
there's two
and
pizza
then you
routine
have 10 teams of those
exactly, and then you have teams of teams, and then more bigger you shouldn't be, like 200 people maybe, or 150 depending on how social your guys are.
Yeah, and that's also how social is somebody. And
then, yeah, you have to rank it.
Yeah
there is there is a column
yeah.
in the onboarding sheet, and it says how social is he, like, or she.
And, yet, and then your manager comes every week and asks you, how did you do on your social metric?
What is your social score? How many beers did you drink? Alone or in company?
Yeah, and if you say, I did 7 this week, he said, well, you're an alcoholic.
Yeah, no, if you're alone, then you're an alcoholic.
Yeah, if you drink with others, it's okay.
It's okay, but you might be also an alcoholic, yeah.
And then, right, I had also, it goes on forever. Let's do agile and social aspects of software engineering in a different thing, because I have tons of stories.
Okay.
But maybe not in English. I can joke forever on it, but I think I want to wrap it up here. So for me, it was about like it seems to be that everybody is now pissed off with Rails, which I think is not fair, because all other frameworks basically have the same problem. Professor Sussman makes this nice trade-off also between, if you want to have high flexibility, extensibility, dynamic features, you need to trade understanding for ability. And if you have the ability to understand anything really perfect, you also can make it really, really hard and like strong and simple, because you have the whole understanding. And in any regard, any problem, you are the limiting factor, because we humans can only understand certain problems in a certain depth at one point in time. So we are the limiting factor here. And
I think you train the AI again. Like you had last time, we had this meme that if we train the AI that humans are not worth living, like the carbon footprint thingy.
Yeah.
And if I listen to you, it sounds like the same. Maybe software developers are not worth it because computer can do it much better. But now we're getting to another red hole.
Every system we know on Earth has a bounded, like, or a hatched context where it fits in and where it has its ability. Like a small amoeba thingy can only do its thing it's supposed to be.
Yeah, it's intelligent design, is it?
Well, I don't know if there's, if there's the great designer, but did you know Mumford and Sons in this one song, they are actually very religious. They talk about the great designer and how everything is actually true.
okay.
Really, really weird. I like the music from Mumford and Sons, but then I heard
I went to a concert.
Oh, wow.
Last week. Or the week before.
Ooh. Yeah, but in the end, I'm just saying that you need to be aware of your limitations.
Yeah, but because that's true for life.
You sometimes you aim for stuff that is not worth aiming for because it's like it's not achievable.
Yeah, true. And then in this iterative scheme of programming, it's always bad to have like visions that span too far.
Yeah, you should have visions, but then not be really crazy with it.
Yeah. You should have a goal and then iterate towards a goal, but not make 5 iterations at one.
Yeah, and it's just like, and that's basically common sense.
Yeah.
So you're in for a Linux container now, or we skip this for?
I would
actually read up the book we
The book?
I don't know, 3 or 4 weeks ago we got these research paper of like 200 pages where I get the introduction from you. You printed it out.
Ah, yeah.
And I didn't read up on this, so I if you go up and everything Docker and stuff, I need to be.
Yeah, I haven't read it myself.
No, Christian, this is not right. Please explain it to me. And I can't do it right now.
Yeah, we are now 1,700 seconds. It's basically half an hour, right?
Half an hour.
Yeah, half an hour. So we have still time. Yeah, I just wanted to. I read a cool article, and I will put it in the show notes if I can make the show notes, or in the blog post that I will put on my blog for this episode. There's a cool article talking about if containers will win the war with hypervisors, if there is a war. I don't know. I forgot the exact title. But the notion was,
hypervisors are dead or something.
Yeah, hypervisors are dead. Yeah, exactly. And he was explaining very nicely the history behind hypervisors and how containers are differentiating in these terms, and which wasn't quite clear or so clear to me, to be honest, that the hypervisor, I mean, this was clear. I mean, back in the days, the hypervisor was the guy who was in charge of the different rings in the CPU. So if you issue a syscall, which is a protective or a high level syscall, or like you want to access a disk or something, then you have to manage the different syscalls from different processes to not override things and not be in conflict. So if you have like heavy syscalls, then you have to access the deeper layer or the ring layer, the ring zero layer in the CPU, and this has to be protected. And the hypervisor, what it does back in the days was, he was fencing the CPU from the virtual machine. So if the virtual machines wanted to access a disk, then the hypervisor exposes this ring zero syscall to the virtual machine. But under the hood, he was saying, okay, you want to access the disk? Sure, we will do the disk. Yeah? And then the virtual machine went off and said, okay, I will wait until I access the disk. And the virtual machine was not aware that he's not really in charge of the disk itself, because there are other virtual machines and the host system that would access the disk at the same time. So he was just told, okay, I will deal with it, just wait. And then the hypervisor was he was a process, so he was just trying to access the disk as the other programs on the system as well. And so it was hiding the complexity to the virtual machine just by being an intermediary to the virtual to the CPU, basically, right? And which I knew, but I wasn't that aware that he put it out very nicely that with Intel introducing technology into the CPU, which was dealing with this abstraction layer, which called VTX and VTD and all that, it was introducing the means that the virtual machine was handled by the CPU itself and that the hypervisor doesn't have to do much work anymore. So the disk and network stuff was still dealt with special drivers, but the rest of the management was offloaded to the CPU, and the hypervisor was basically, or is still basically, just a framework of dealing with the drivers for the special special drivers for disk and network stuff. So back in the days, I said it was like the shielder for the complete ring zero, ring one stuff.
I guess the point here, or the point as I understood in the post, was the invention of the hypervisor was forced from other companies and done, and it was a real software solution.
Yeah.
And then as it got adopted more and more, the main or important part, which is a good thing basically, down a stack to the CPU level where it can be even faster. So you get more performance out of virtualization. But now the hypervisor is nothing more than
the intermediary for the different...
It doesn't do the complex stuff anymore.
Yeah, it has to do the drivers for network and disk, which is one of the most interesting performance measures, right? The CPU and RAM, it's dealt with from the CPU level, so that's almost the same speed. But for disk and network, you have this hypervisor penalty in between, because he has to map the different functions from the different operating systems to the host system and has to do some work. Yeah, and this was laid out very nicely, and he argued that, and I think that's a common theme we see in IT in the last 20, 30 years, that everything complex is broken down and heterogeneous is broken down to more homogeneous and more simple building blocks, and that we commoditize a lot of stuff. I mean, we commoditized the computers back in the 80s, 90s, when Windows was evolving. We commoditized x86 in the end of the 90s, when we had the first supercomputers with big x86 systems, where the compute hardware was becoming more and more cheap compared to the very complex and very big systems we had before, like the vector machines and whatnot. And nowadays, the software, the last couple of years, software is more and more commoditized to the open source movement. I think that's not unfair to say. Like all the stacks we got from AWS and stuff, they're using open source technology, and everyone is more and more open with this, and everything is commoditized. And the next step might be that even the operating system itself, it's very boiled down to what we really need, and that the application and the complexity is hidden in some other thing, like a container, like that you just have an application which is packaged not as a bunch of files, but it's packaged as something that you can directly run on your framework.
I guess what you like,
but I'm not sure if I convey it.
Now we need to lay it out a bit bigger. Now our who's he? Guido is Italian. Yeah, everybody's laughing at us. We're actually recording out of the office, and we come in early, and the SRE guys are always coming in late or later, and
But it's not hard to.
Now he's making pictures.
Selfie, podcast selfie.
So the container stuff, I think it's more to it. But the last point you say, there was this like, how do you run and execute a program, and you need certain stuff for it. And then Microsoft with Windows introduced this executable, the .exe file, right? And it was everything together, and it could be executed on the Microsoft operating system.
Yeah.
And that was great. Yeah. Or not.
But it had some point.
And then I think then the next step was actually, oh my God, we have no pointers. over and over, Zach Fault, blah, blah, blah. So Sun came in and said, well, we will build a decent GVM. So the theory about GVMs was already out there. The university was good enough, and Sun could actually create the Java virtual machine. And it was like not good at the beginning and became better and better and better after, like, now, I don't know, almost 20 years, 25 years or so. And then you have this .jar file where you have all files together and a registry internally where you say this file is dependent on this and this and that and blah, blah, blah. And the whole dependency trees of the source code is bundled within the same thing. And then Microsoft came across several years later and said, well, that's not a bad idea at all. When we want to get more stability in our operating system and not segfaulting all the time, we come up with a common CLR. What's that? Common library RL, common runtime library. I guess that's the .NET, basically, what the first DM basically for Windows operating system. And now the Linux world has its, like, we have the packages in Debian, we have RPMs in what's that, SUSE or Red Hat, whatever the RPM packages. And we have these packages where we have modular systems that we attach to the operating system. But with the containers, this is more like get the application and the operating system.
Yeah, separated somehow. Yeah, but yeah, we will talk about it, I think, in the subsequent podcast. But yeah, I think what you just talked about is the application or the developer's point of view, right? So you package your
how can I get my code to the user?
Yeah,
and not worry about, like, the complex stuff in between.
Yeah, and what?
That's what a developer does.
Yeah, yeah, sure, no. And I mean, we had virtual machines for, like, also 20 years, or I don't know, 15 years maybe. And they were greatly adopted in IT because they are easy to adopt, since you can just add, if you want a new IP for your physical machine, then you can just add a new box, checkbox on your form, which says, is it a physical or a virtual machine? And then you have adopted the full-fledged virtual machine enterprise or yada yada environment, right? So you can shoehorn, you do not even have to shoehorn it. Virtual machines back in the days, or even today, they are just another means of physical machine. And with Linux containers, but yeah, we have to take more time and
yeah, let's make
just one last sentence. Like, Linux containers, they are just bundling a user land without all the init system and all the setup that you need, which you needed in virtual machine. So Linux containers are just userland bundling, with just userland bundling. It's a userland bundling, and it's very, very nice. And we will talk about it later in the subsequent podcast.
I know that my listeners of the podcast love Docker, and I love Docker too, because it makes it really, and now we come to, it's, maybe it's not simple, but it's actually easy to use. Because I'd never looked at behind the scenes, obviously. I'm a developer, I don't care. But it's really easy to use, and it does work.
Yeah, and I think this is one of the cool goals for Docker Inc. They are focusing, I'm not a Docker fanboy per se, because
breaking news, the whole BI Berlin team is working from home today.
The whole BI, yeah. No, I'm not a Docker fanboy per se, because I would be fine with other Linux containers technologies. But Docker, they focus on usability for the developer. Then they say, okay, I want to push it out, something out that everyone can use. And we should commoditize software development. So everyone should be able to build something without setting up too much stuff. So you can, if you want to build Elasticsearch backed software and you don't want to set up Elasticsearch, you just download your Elasticsearch container and then you push your JavaScript stuff out there, and then you can just easily iterate on it without setting up all the hassle that you have to go through if you want to set up Elasticsearch, or let alone HBase or HDFS. Or so you can have, like, stacks of software to program against without the hassle of setting them up. And even you can iterate very fast on your own on your own stuff, because you can just put it also in a container and then kick the container, create a new container, kick the container, and iterate very fast. And this is, I think, the real benefit. And this is where Docker says, Docker Inc. says, we would like to put out software that helps developers do great stuff. And I think that's totally the correct way of doing it. I mean, the opposite way would be, we would like to push out Linux containers to operate very fine, and then like address the operations guys and the engineers and that are more inclined with the operations part. And this is, I think, a red hole that you can get very easily into, like discussing how to run the legacy is very hard, but discussing how to get new developers, new talent to work easier, that's the easy part.
Yeah, and also developers feel like they can actually deploy.
Yeah, and they're independent.
In this illusion that they know stuff about stuff. And that's what developers like. Wild guessing.
Yeah, no, and they yeah, and they can deploy it on their laptop and feel like they are independent, and they can and I think that's the good thing is that, I mean, back in the days the developer would say, it works on my laptop. Yeah. And then he pushes it to the operations guys, and he says, yeah, okay, it's nice. It works on your laptop, but how do I reproduce it?
The servers are burning, and they constantly run out of memory every 50 seconds. Maybe you want to yeah. look into your application.
But nowadays, if you say it works on my laptop, if it's in Docker, then it's easier to port. I don't say that it fixes all the problems. Or that's for sure not the case, but it makes it easier.
I mean,
easier.
It's our podcast, our like some people are definitely not listening to this podcast, so you can be very open about it.
Okay, I think it will fix everything.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to hear.
Okay, but
it's just a matter of time. But I guess we will. So we know what the upcoming episodes will be. Something will be about the social impacts or the social aspects of software development with regard to something called Scrum
or Kanban.
Well, I mean, Kanban works. The Toyota cars are actually very good.
Yeah.
It seems to be a good process. But I don't know. Hey, I would like to ask, by the way, JetBrains, what they do to develop their IDEs, because their IDE seems to be also a very good piece of software. I wonder if they also use Scrum. I don't know. But so upcoming episodes are social software engineering and social aspects of software engineering and Linux container and split it for development, and just leave it with development for the first time.
Yeah, we would see where we go.
We can also then scare the hell out of everybody to say it's unsecure, it's not reliable, it will fall over. It will kill humanity.
There are scary.
I will not. I have a meme of the week, but I'm too tired of actually talking about it. I want to mention the Hacker News story of actually not this week but last week, and there was a nice blog post which had a lot of links, maybe all of the important papers with regard to distributed computing. And it's called Distributed System Theory for the Distributed System Engineer.
Systems
Engineer. And really, it is like, it points out the RAF paper, it points out the Paxos paper, it talks about the CAP theorem, and it's a very nice overview, like from a high-level perspective, but then it points out every important paper that has ever been written about this topic, and if you are interested, you should check out this blog post, and the link will be in the show notes.
Or the blog post. More likely the blog post, because the show notes. But yeah, I try.
Now we have to see how that fits. I guess some. No, it's limited actually, so we don't get too much of that.
Okay.
Okay, you're tired too.
Yeah, I don't know why. I should drink more coffee. It's just 10:30.
Yeah, let's have a coffee or two.
Yeah, okay. Let's enter the Hausmeisterei. So what is it?
Housekeeping?
Housekeeping. That makes sense.
Podcast keeping?
Maybe we should talk about, or we just should mention where we are at Twitter, for instance. My handle is CQNIEB. So CKNIEB.
I cannot spell my Twitter handle.
It's S-O...
The first letter would be an S, and then an S, and then an O, and then an G, and then an O, and then an N, and then
an E,
and
then an R. No, a J, not a G.
G? Oh, a J, yes.
So Jonah.
See, so I can't spell my name.
C-O-J-O-N-E-R, right?
I have to ask myself all the time why I end up using the keyboard so much, because I'm really like, actually, I have a doctor assessment that says, you are not capable of typing. But then, yeah.
Yeah, we need text to speech to text. Yeah, and we try to make our show notes better than last time. If we don't succeed, then you can find the stuff on qneib.org. And there is a link on the upper right called Insert Buzzwords. Buzzword. Yeah, and there I will push out a blog post about this podcast and just for this episode with the links that we talked about. Yeah, okay, cool. And if you want to get in touch, as I said, we have this two hashtags or Twitter handles, or you can send an email to podcast@qneb.org. Yeah, we like to get feedback about our English, maybe. Or not our English, but should continue in English, or if we should continue altering between German and English.
I guess it's like, I had more fun with the German one because it's way more funnier.
Yeah, because that's our native language, yeah. Right? But I think the audience is bigger in English. I think
it is bigger,
I think we are
not
limited to Germany. We are a worldwide podcast.
But
we
hate the studio to looks try like to a worldwide be like podcast. Try to explain myself very explicitly, be concentrated on my words. I'm not like easy with jokes. My jokes suck in English.
Yeah, for jokes you should consider listening to the German one. But yeah, or maybe Goethe Institutes are all over the place.
It's all brave. I think it's just like the whole language English became so politically correct that it's actually, it feels bad to make a joke.
Because you do not know how it's conceived. That's a problem, right?
I know any joke, any fun, like I guess. Oh no, 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 I'm fulfilling the explicit tech. I save these words I want to speak to myself because too harsh to other people in other countries.
Oh.
Yeah.
Who are you?
No, and that's the point. That's the point. You cannot speak freely. Like, you know it's not correct and you will harm somebody's feelings. So, no jokes. That's it. Political correctness all over it.
That's sad.
You have a high note to finish on?
Yeah. Let's say Docker one last time and then
Docker.
Okay. Guys. Bye bye.
Good week.